This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When author Frank Morelli was in high school, his grandfather moved in with the family. His grandfather had recently been diagnosed with a progressive form of dementia and needed daily support. Even though Frank was young, he could see how hard the caregiving was on his father. As the disease progressed, his dad struggled to keep his promise to provide a death with dignity. This experience stayed with Frank long after his grandfather's death, and eventually it became the inspiration for his new book. It's called No Sad Songs. Frank Morelli joins us now. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good afternoon, Frank. I appreciate you having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Let's talk about your personal experience before we get to the book and what that was like for you.
Well, when I was about 14 years old, we started to notice a lot of changes in my grandfather, and he was the kind of person that would remember just about everything. He would give me birthday cards. He was the first person to send them, show up to my games, my Little League games, when I didn't even tell them about them. And then we just started to notice these little changes. Most of them were personality changes. He became quiet and kind of withdrawn. Sometimes he would come to my house and just kind of sit in the corner, and we wouldn't hear him speak a lot. But there was a lot of there wasn't a lot of us noticing or wanting to notice. We wanted to kind of, I guess we kind of wanted to push it to the side and just, you know, think that everything was normal. He was just getting older. But then things started to get a little more drastic, and we eventually decided that he needed to see a doctor, and they diagnosed him with Pick's disease, which is the form of dementia you were talking about. And from that point on, things started to progress. And I was not a caregiver. I guess I wouldn't consider myself to be an actual caregiver at the time, although I did pitch in here and there. But I got a chance to watch my parents do it. They were adults at the time, obviously, and it really just took a huge strain for them. I know economically it hurt them. I know that it really cut into their daily life and their time, but they never really showed that. They masked it. They continued going about their lives. It was a really admirable to watch, but at the same time, extremely sad. And I remember at the time feeling extremely helpless. Like, what could I do? I'm just a kid. I was kind of an immature kid at that age, even going through up to maybe, I don't know, now. And
there may not be a mature 14-year-old. I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know how to define that, but I take your point.
But even when I was in my 20s, I started to think about what I could have done and how I could have helped. And I've talked to my parents about it, and really there wasn't much I could have done more than what they were already doing. So I guess this feeling kind of just brewed inside me for a long period of time, and I thought I needed to express it somehow. I needed to reach other people who had the same experience or may have had similar experiences to me. So I decided that I wanted to write this book that was kind of speculative in nature, in that I was going to be able to live through this character who was a caregiver, who didn't have his parents to fall back on. And the impetus was Gabe Lascuda, who is my protagonist. So,
tell us more about Gabe and No Sad Songs.
Well, Gabe is an 18-year-old young man. He is not like the most popular kid at school or anything like that, although he has aspirations for that. He wants to really just fit in, do the kind of things that any normal teenager would want to do. He's trying to make the baseball team. He's a real baseball fan. He's trying to gain some popularity. He's trying to fall in love and find dates and things of that nature. But at the same time, you know, he's just lost his parents in a tragic accident, and he wants to take on the responsibility that they had been taking on, which was taking care of his grandfather, who has a similar disease to what my own grandfather had. The character in the book, Grandpa, is in the latter stages of this when Gabe takes over. And the book is really about Gabe trying to live his life as a teenager and, you know, have all these things that he wants to have in his life that all of his friends around him have, and at the same time live up to the responsibilities that are really adult responsibilities. And, you know, the book is definitely a coming-of-age story. You definitely see Gabe grow throughout the book. And one of the features in it is that there's a personal essay project that he's working on for one of his classes, and he's comparing poetry that they're studying to events from his life. So he takes the opportunity to kind of remember his grandfather the way he wants to remember him, and for the man that he used to be before he has turned into somebody that's almost unrecognizable to him. And that's one of the things that helps him to kind of get through this and to kind of continue to care for his grandfather to the best of his ability.
Well, I wonder if I can ask you to read for us.
Sure. In fact, I'd like to read a portion of one of the essays that's in the book. It's takes Gabe back to a time when he had his first catch with his grandfather, you know, perfect American moment. Grandpa wound back and tossed the ball. The top half caught the sun and gleamed in white. The bottom half was the dark side of the moon. The laces flipped and twirled, and I fought hard to keep myself from jumping out of the way and disappointing Grandpa. Then I felt leather make contact with leather. The weight gathered in the pocket. There was a soft snap as my bare hand clamped over the front of the glove. Would you look at that? My grandson's a freaking natural. The next Willie Mays, Dad said. The next Willie Mays. I often think about moments like these, the ones that feel so light and carefree at the time, but that carry with them much heavier insights. It's only in the future, after time has beaten the ever-loving crap out of you, that you realize what was actually taking place on a day like that. And it reminds me of one of Robert Frost's most famous poems, which also happens to appear in one of my favorite books of all time, The Outsiders. I may have read S.E. Hinton's most popular book way back in middle school, but I will never forget the sage insight Johnny Cade gives Ponyboy through Frost's words. They still ring in my ears. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today, nothing gold can stay. When the ball popped my mitt that day, so many years ago when I could barely see over the shoulders of a cricket, and I squeezed it before it flipped lifelessly to the grass, I had held on to more than just the ball. I had held that gold in my hand, the hardest hue, and Gramps and Dad recognized it immediately, for they had once held the same hue in their own hands.
It's Frank Morelli reading from his novel, No Sad Songs. There's a lot in that essay, and I think it shines a light on a little bit of many of the things we've been talking about. But first, let's talk about just the stress and strain of having to be in that position, right? I mean, anybody watching someone deteriorate like that, struggling with losing the person they know. I mean, later he comes to this insight, but it's later. It's not while it's happening. And then having to live your life, whether you're an adult or a child. I mean, that by itself is a pretty stressful.
Yeah, I mean, for myself and speaking from my own experience, just the act of watching the whole mm-hmm. situation take place, it did take a toll on me. And it wasn't a toll that I recognized. I heard Tawana talking before this on the segment before where she said she didn't even really realize that she was a caregiver. And, you know, I've had similar moments too. I wasn't a caregiver, but I could definitely think back as an adult and remember all the different times that it impacted my life, that it impacted, you know, how tired I was in school the next day, that I probably felt depressed at times and sad about watching somebody who I loved very much, you know, just deteriorate slowly. And the same is true for my character. I tried to really kind of connect emotionally on that level with my character. And he even has added things that he has to do. Many of the things that we just heard the two guests talking about, you know, medication schedules, taking Grandpa to doctor's visits, just being seen in public with him and trying to be the teenager that he wants to be and keep his, you know, semi-cool image alive at school. All those things kind of play into Gabe's life, just like they played into my own back when I was watching this take place.
So a few minutes ago, we talked about this thing as though it were a thing. Did you know that? How aware were you of the fact that people were actually studying this and saw it as its own source of inquiry?
When I was younger, I had absolutely no idea that it was a thing. I had no feeling that I was involved in something that was different than what it was supposed to be. You know, when you're part of a family, you have people that you care for, and no matter what happens to them, you're going to care for them. And that's really kind of how I viewed it, because that's how my parents viewed it at the time. They were going to do whatever they could to, you know, give my grandpa his dignity as he was fading away. Yeah, doing research on the book, I realized that there are a lot of organizations out there, more so than when I was going through this in the mid to late 90s. And, you know, that's really encouraging to me to know that it could become recognized as something that's important, because I think it really should be. Just like Tawana was mentioning, you know, the more we can put this into the spotlight and take that stigma away from being a caregiver, I think the better off youth caregivers especially will be. They'll have a chance to come out, explain what it is that they do, which is really important and a very difficult job to do, especially as a kid. And it'll provide them support and allow them to continue to do what they're doing while still, maintaining a life of, you know, being who they want to be.
Well, and also if they can come out and understand that there's support for them and they don't have to hide this fact, learn to enjoy some of the benefits, because that's clearly what happens here. There's a lot of the literature that we study in school, which if we haven't been allowed to mature, if we've had it, you know, in many ways too soft and not have to show this kind of empathy and contribute in this sort of way, a lot of the literature that's been written is lost on us because it's about this kind of transformation through these experiences. A kid in that position can gain a lot from school if they're allowed to actually be a student as well as a caregiver.
I agree. And I just to add to that, I remember I didn't have the experience where I was trying to hide this information from people that I knew because I was afraid that I was going to get taken away. Right. But I did hide it from people because I was afraid that people would think differently of my grandfather and they would think differently of me. And that sounds kind of selfish. It's a very, I guess, it's a kind of a teenage thing to be thinking. But I distinctly remember just trying to just be really quiet about it. I didn't accept help from anybody, but mostly that's because nobody knew that it was even really going on until after the fact.
Can I ask you to read again from the book?
Sure. Just kind of introduce this little part. This is a part about another character that's in the book. Her name's Sophia, and she also is facing some difficulties with her own mother and is kind of a caregiver herself and has dropped out of school to do it. She's a tattoo artist, and if you look at her, she seems to be on the fringes of society. And one of the reasons I wanted to include her in the book is because I wanted people to understand that in some way we're all kind of on the fringe of society. So she kind of helps Gabe through this ordeal that he has, mostly through her own examples that she sets. This is the first time she comes in to the story. She spins around and heads for a chair facing mine. My eyes instantly shoot down onto my notebook. She smells kind of nice when she walks past, kind of like warm tortillas and lavender. I keep my eyes on the notebook, jotting fake notes in the margins and underlining things like a madman just to make myself look scholarly. Before I know it, there's a border so thick and black around the lines of Thoreau's poem that it looks like a picture frame. And the notebook paper is flimsy and full of all these tiny holes that make it look perforated. I try to cover it up with my hand, but she's already turning down the volume on her Walkman. She's already pulling one earpiece and then the other from her ears. She's already taking a deep breath and getting ready to say something. "So, I bet you think you're pretty deep," she says. She speaks like a statue, her eyes still and her lips thin and barely moving. I'm not sure if she's talking to me or if she's just floating her words out there on the stale hospital air, maybe to get trapped in the thumb of a latex glove or under the plunger of a syringe. "Me?" I ask. I look around to make sure I'm still the only other person in the waiting room. "No, I'm talking to that guy." She points to the table where a stack of magazines is topped with a Mr. Potato Head figurine. Poor guy is faceless and only has one ear. I feel a little sorry for him, to tell you the truth. "Yeah," I say. "That guy's been chatting me up all morning. Doesn't even have a damn mouth. That's just that one lonely ear." She pops off the ear and slips it in a tiny pocket on the sleeve of her leather jacket. She smiles without showing her teeth, just a few sly wrinkles at the corners of her mouth. "That better?" I nod. "Good," she says. She continues to stare at the crinkled page of my notebook. "I'm not that deep, if that's what you're thinking." That's not what I'm thinking.
Frank Morelli reading from his new book, No Sad Songs. Frank's going to do a book signing at the Barnes & Noble in High Point on Saturday, June 9th. Of course, we've got that on our website, stateofthings.org. What did you went through the experience yourself, albeit, as you say, not the primary caregiver, but as someone who is very close to the situation. And now you've written a book. Has it changed any of your thinking? What are your insights since then?
Well, one thing that has changed me is that at the time when I was a teenager, I used to kind of think about it as a bit of an anchor, like it was something that could have been detrimental to my life. But as an adult, I realized that it was the opposite of that, you know, and I think that we're put into positions in life sometimes that we don't expect, and sometimes those are the best things for us. This was one of those opportunities for me, I would say. It took me lots of time, many, many years to kind of internalize this and be able to turn it into a book. But the experiences that I went through and that I was able to witness when I was at that age helped me to kind of understand what true responsibility is and understand how important it is to kind of care for the people around you no matter what, that there's more important things out there in the world than worrying about trivial things.
Yeah, it's interesting to put this in context, because often you can hear that and you can feel what a great reward it is. And sometimes people take that as, so you have to do it yourself. But it's precisely because you can do it in community. It's with the support of others around you. It's when you tell other people and when other people are organized to support you that actually you can take the benefits, right?
That's why it's so great to hear about some of the organizations that Betsy was laying out in the previous segment, because just if I would have had somebody back then to kind of guide me through this and or even other people to bounce my own experiences off of, so that they can just tell me, hey, I'm going through the same kind of thing, it would have felt a lot different. I think I probably would have been more equipped to help my parents and to provide support more so than I did at the time. And because I can think back and I feel like I was more of a fly on the wall, which I guess in the long run wound up kind of paying off for me. But at the time, I really wish that I could go back and be able to provide more support. If I had other people in my life that were more knowledgeable, because my parents really weren't, they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants. Mm-hmm. If I had other people, doctors, teachers especially, that were able to guide me, that had known about my experience, then it probably would have made my parents' job a lot easier.
Frank, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, Frank.
Frank Morelli is the author of No Sad Songs. He's going to do a book signing at the Barnes & Noble in High Point on Saturday, June 9th. And, of course, you can find out more about that event and everything we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.